And welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with us at Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I'm joined by my co-host for the purposes of this intro, Mr. Phil Brining. Hello, Phil.
Hiya, Ollie. How are you doing?
I am very well, thank you, Phil. The weather is absolutely gorgeous. I'm particularly chipper, and we just had what I think was a great session.
Yeah, you know, we've just literally come off it, and I can't remember what we talked about.
See, this is where we need Holmes back, because he's always got some snappy title ready to go, because he's better at this than we are. But it was an episode of GDPR Radio this week, wasn't it? Which is the open surgery. We talk about what's been in the news. We spent a lot of time talking, possibly for with little output, about the IDTAs, International Data Transfer Agreements, which have just come into force, didn't we? We spoke a lot about that and the fact
that
basically it's a bit confusing.
Well, we're confused, and it sounds like other people that we were talking to are also confused. And the principal piece of confusion, you know, is just whether or not we are able to use a new European SECs, you know, and what the addendum is there for. So it's just, I was a bit confused, because the International Data Transfer Agreements are the IDTAs. And the addendum, you know, isn't an IDTA. It's the new addendum, I think it's referred to, isn't it? So, but it was quite good fun, actually, because we had a look through, you know, the transitional arrangements, which refer to Schedule 21 of the Data Protection Act. When we had a look, there isn't a Schedule 21 of the Data Protection Act. When we looked a bit further back in time, there was in the past. So we had quite a good discussion and a laugh, really, about how confusing the whole thing is at the moment, and it just requires a bit of clarification. And we looked at a couple of you know, pretty good sources of other law, you know, law firms, and, you know, that opinions that no, you can't use the new European SECs, but then some confusion as maybe you can with the new addendum. So we're going to do some further work on that, aren't we?
We're going to do some further work and try and work it out, because, as we said on the podcast, we haven't got the answers, but then again, I'm not sure people come here for the answers. It's been suggested that we put that on a t-shirt and sell it this summer, so Miles, if you want to get on that, who knows. But yes, we spoke a lot about that. We spoke about CCTV for disciplinary purposes, which I think was a good an interesting
chat.
That was
a really good discussion, and we got some really good comments back from the other, you know, participants in the session.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'd urge you to listen to that specifically. And also just generally about some of the culture around these things, right? How we perceive subject rights and how we perceive the rights of individuals versus organisations. That's a really good topic. And there's also some other bits and pieces about just news items. So there was a hack on Okta Verify recently. We talked about that a little bit, which is relevant because one of the points we raise is due diligence. And due diligence is the topic of our next session. So we're talking due diligence next week. If you want to come along to that, please do get in touch. Should be really, really useful. We talk a lot about due diligence and how to tailor it properly and sorts of things you want to look for, what to avoid, etc. So it'd be good to get stuck into that, I think, Phil.
I think you're right. Yeah, it's a shame Dave's not here for that, because he would be taking a very, I think, high academic view of it. So one of us is going to have to probably, you know, what is diligence? You know, what is due diligence? So I think we need to do a bit of prep on it, to be honest, to equip ourselves. But as I said, I'm out all next week auditing PCI DSS in a bunch of retail outlets, so I might struggle to spend time.
You know, sounds like it might just be a monologue for me then at this rate. But no, yeah, it's shame Dave's not here for it, but Dave will be back soon. I'll prep some terrible dad jokes in the meantime to cover for him, because we need our quota. So yeah, that should be fun. Good, as I say, good session this week. We won't keep you too much longer before letting you get stuck into this episode, listener. Just a few points of admin. As we say, if you do want to get involved in any of the live sessions, all the events are listed on the Data Protection People website under the events page. We had a bit of a drought for topics, but now we've been absolutely swamped with them, which is fantastic. It's what we love. People getting in touch, telling us what to cover. So if you've got any suggestions, do get in touch. And more broadly, if you've got feedback about how we can improve the podcast in any way, do let us know. We're always looking to improve it. Last thing, I'm going to keep going on about this until it gets sorted. But we need you all, if you can, to provide us with a rating on whatever platform you listen to this to, good, bad, ugly. However you feel about it, any ratings are going to be useful, although obviously we prefer 5 stars. Any ratings at all just to get us off the ground is going to be helpful. So if you wouldn't mind and you enjoy the podcast, we'd really, really appreciate it. Without further ado, Phil.
Final point. Just to say that we've got one of our regular participants on the podcast visiting Leeds today. So he said, you know, are you free for a coffee? So we said, yeah, of course we are. You know, drop into the office and have a cup of tea with us and, you know, chew the fat over things, which is fantastic. We'd love to do that. So if anybody is around in Leeds and they fancy a chat, you know, then do let us know, because, you know, we what we're like talking, this kind of stuff. But also he said to, well, if you're around at 12:30, you could come into the studio and you know, do the podcast live. So again, if you're around and you fancy hooking up with us or just meeting up for a chat or whatever, or participating, you know, live, then let us know, because you know, this is all about you know, working with a fantastic community of people, isn't it?
Absolutely, could not agree with you more, and we're really looking forward to that. We've not been able to make it happen this week, but it's certainly not done the water. There's certainly plans to make that happen, so hopefully we'll be having one of our long-time contributors joining us sooner rather than later. Without further ado, Phil, anything else you want to cover, or should we let them get stuck in? Excellent. Yeah. Well, in that case, I shall leave you to this latest episode of GDPR Radio. So on that note, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. I am one of your co-hosts, Ollie Rear. I am joined by my colleague, Phil Brining, this afternoon. Just the two of us. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Ollie. Hello, everyone.
Yes, hello, everyone, indeed. If you are new to these sessions, well, first of all, welcome along. It's lovely to have you. This is a very open community space, so the more people, the better. The more opinions, the better. Before we get into today's episode, which is an episode of GDPR Radio, so open forum, just an opportunity to kick around what we've seen in the news relating to the privacy space, what we've been working on, some thoughts, feelings, opinions, etc. Just a couple of points of admin to get out of the way. First things first, we do record these, put them out as the podcast afterwards. There's a privacy notice relating to that on screen right now, so just let us know if you've got any issues with that at all. As I mentioned just a second ago, this is a very open space. It's by no means the Phil and Ollie show, so please do get involved. Mark has already done that. I was chatting to him off air, so Mark's been straight in, sharing things in the chat. So if you've got anything to contribute at all, comments, queries, questions, concerns, anything, please do pop them in the chat. I'll keep an eye on that and raise them at the appropriate intervals, or raise your hand, unmute, get stuck in. We get some really great engagement, and it always makes the sessions better. Last couple of things before we get into it properly. As you know, we run not just these open surgery type sessions, but we also run themed events. We had a bit of a drought for topics last week, in all honesty, and we're now absolutely overflowing with events and topics to cover. So thank you to all of you who contributed, who wrote in, got in touch with suggestions of things they'd like to see. We've got absolutely loads of events now coming up. If you want to find out about what we're going to be covering, head to the events page on the brand new DPP website. I think Mars might be sharing it on the screen in just a second. There we go. List of events. We've got some really fab things coming up. In particular, one that I want to highlight because I'm excited about this, and I want to generate a bit hype around it, is our ISO 27001 event. So we're going to be joined by, some of you may know, Stuart Barker, who's going to be coming along to talk to us privacy pros about ISO 27001, what it's all about, demystifying it a bit. I'm looking forward to that because I don't know as much as I possibly should about it. So we hope to see you on that one. Right, I've probably done enough talking for now, Phil. Do you want to get stuck into the odd bit that you might have seen in the news? I know you've had your head down this week. We obviously have to talk about the IDTAs, which we've been rumbling on about quite a bit, haven't we? International Data Transfer Agreement. Do you want to start there, or is there anywhere else that you want to begin?
Well, I, in the news, I noticed the Okta hack, which yeah. I think you want to talk about, which was quite worrying. And also, Mark's highlighted something about the British Army, which is thank you for that, Mark. British soldiers ordered off WhatsApp amid fears that sensitive military details could be accessed by Russian hackers. So, I mean, there's obviously some major cyber concerns, you know, with various things going on in the world. So, interesting. But what did you see on the Okta hack? Because I had to look and find out who they actually were and who they might have affected. Oct, I'd not heard of it before.
Now, see, that's interesting because I think there probably are a number of people on session who might be familiar with Okta because certain organizations use them very heavily. And basically what they are is a provider of two-factor authentication.
Mm.
So they generate codes for your login when you're using a new system or sometimes depending on how it's set up, every new login, whatever it might be. But basically the two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication, right? I've used them in previous roles and I still use them for bits and pieces where I need to. But I thought this hack was interesting for a number of reasons, right? So they suffered a cyber attack, which they claimed wasn't a big issue, but considering some of the clients that they have, the size of some of the clients they have, so one of the names that was thrown around was like FedEx and, you know, really big organizations. And obviously, if your two-factor authentication is compromised, well, you could be in quite a lot of trouble.
Could you? I mean, I haven't thought this one through, but why would you be? So,
well, that's a good point, actually. Would you be? I think conceptually, I can see how it could be problematic, but you're not necessarily logged in to one way of doing multi-factor authentication, are you?
Well, I use Google Authenticator, for instance, so it just gives me a code. So assuming that Google Authenticator got hacked in the same way, and please do jump in it, those who are more technically knowledgeable than me, the hackers would give me a false code or a code that didn't work. But I just was trying to struggle with, if it's MFA, how does it actually, you know, they don't have the passwords, do they? They just, I suppose you set up an account, don't you? So
I think
you know which application you're trying to log into.
Yeah, I think the angle I was coming at it from was more from if you are locked out your systems because your MFA is knackered.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think you probably can swap, but I don't know about you. So for instance, I on our Salesforce tendency, I'm set up on Salesforce Authenticator specifically, and I know that it can be quite difficult to change from one authenticator to another because it's kind of the nature of the beast.
Yeah, I just use Google for everything, but then the more accounts you get, the more complicated it gets. I've got several Salesforce developer accounts, for instance, so you know, you've got to make sure that each one is distinctly different, and Authenticator. But anyway, that's just, again, a great idea. As soon as you start scaling it, you think, oh, Christ, you know, I've got like 100 of these authenticator apps. And so by the time I've scrolled through it, you know, it's, anyway. Yeah. So that was Okta I saw in the news. That was interesting, I thought.
Well, just before we move on from that, if that's all right, there's one point specifically I wanted to raise in relation to this, which is instantly in their reporting, one of the things that Okta said was, actually, it's not us that have been compromised. It's one of our sub-processors.
They did, yes, I saw that, yeah.
And
yeah,
it's specifically, I think, potentially a contractor, at least an employee for one of our sub-processors. And I thought that was interesting because one of the things it highlights, obviously, is you need to be doing your due diligence because, I mean, this sort of thing might not be, you know, there's no way to count some of these things, but it does highlight that supply chain, as soon as issues manifest themselves, they can very quickly spiral, right? You never know.
Yeah, but what, again, interesting, again, was that the engineers, according to the news report, the engineers' computer hadn't provided sort of godlike access, you know, to wasn't super admin or something, and the hackers had been constrained in what they could do. So they seem to have got in via an engineer's computer, but then one would think that sensible and appropriate privileges in the system has limited the damage. Again, that's all the more reason to, you know, make sure that security profiles in the systems are, you know, limiting people to just the minimum that they need in terms of data and functionality. You know, anything broader than what's the minimum needed is going to expose you to issues in the event of something like this happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's one of those things, right? Is if you're set up properly in respect of access controls or even things like your JML, joiners, movers, leavers, procedures, etc. If you set up properly, then you're going to massively minimise the risk. I raised this because we had quite an interesting question in to our support desk earlier this week. You might remember, Phil, we used to do this more regularly of pick out case and discuss them on this forum. We've not done it as much recently.
No, I've got one to talk about as well, to be honest.
But we had quite an interesting one in where, obviously I can't say too much about it for confidentiality reasons, but effectively a client of ours had had an IT contractor working for them, which they had dismissed. And it had taken them about 24 hours to revoke that IT contractor's privileges. in that time, that IT contractor, disgruntled with the dismissal, shall we say, for want of a better term, decided to go and have a look in some of their systems and email a bunch of applicants to want to roll with the business. Some telling them you don't want to work here, some rescinding offers that have been made, etc., getting up to all sorts of mischief. Now, that highlights, obviously, the importance of making sure that your access controls are right, that your permissions are right, and that if you've got, you know, joiners, movers, leavers process, that they're actioned on time. But, I mean, one of the things that come out of that to me when I was reading it with our support desk guys is that's a really, really silly thing to do, because you're putting yourself in Computer Misuse Act territory there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Really, really silly thing to do. So just interesting. Anyway, you said you had a case you wanted to discuss.
Well, only in that I thought I'd throw this out here because it was interesting. I was doing an audit this week of a company, and they collect information about drivers, and including their driving offences. Okay. And they were saying, well, do we need to appoint a data protection officer? And again, I'm kind of throwing it out there to just gauge what people thought, because obviously one of the three triggers for appointing a DPO, or public authorities, large-scale processing, a special category, and criminal convictions and offences is in there as one of those triggers. So, you know, it is a core activity of theirs, and they're doing about 100 a week, taking about 100 a week. So, I mean, my advice to them was, you know, the very least you might be borderline, and therefore you need to document your use case, keep it under review, and if you ever get asked, you've got evidence of having taken an appropriate and recommended approach. But I just wondered, you know, whatever you thought, you know, if that would, if you know, your circumstances, would you think actually, yeah, we'll assume that we need to put a DPO in place? They process insurance fraud claims, basically. So they get referred insurance fraud claims, and they investigate them, and that's why they need the driving offences. They get the driving licence and offences details from the insurance companies.
Mm. Very interesting. I'd have probably, without wanting to be too boring about it, I'd have probably side with what you're saying, which is arguably you're going to be at the very least borderline. Probably just go belt and braces and go ahead and appoint one. I mean, I guess it depends what your resourcing is like, but if you're able to do so, then I'd have thought that just to cover yourself, you'd probably want to be proactive on that. But that's not a very interesting response. But that's what I'd have gone back with.
Yeah. But it's good when you get a case in, or you're doing something and you think, actually, yeah, let's just sort of unpack this. You know, go back to what the guidance says, and you know, think about what scale means, and think about whether it is a core activity, and think about what the whole purpose of having a DPO in the first place is, and then factor that all into a consideration and document it, you know, make a decision and document it. It's just really good fun doing that kind of, you know, intricate work. I really enjoy it.
I think it is, and it reminds me of an anecdote from our times, you know, working through these types of decisions. And I just remember engaging with a now customer who at the time was going out to tender for an outsourced DPO, and apparently a lot of providers had, you know, tendered for this work, etc. And our very own Dave Holmes, I believe, rocked up and sort of said, well, I don't think you do need a DPO, actually. Having looked at it, I've broken it down, not to sort of, you know, do myself out of any work, but I don't actually think you need a DPO. And we looked at it properly, and the consensus was no, they didn't. And actually, in the end, that's what won us the work, is that we'd actually challenged that assumption. But it's good to work through these things. I agree with you. Just to really sort of take it apart, see what's what, and then you get into fabulous things like, well, what do we mean by large scale? What do we mean by core activity, etc.? Which I know you tend to enjoy those types of conversations, certainly, as do I.
Yeah, I've had quite a few occasions where, you know, you challenge, you know, there's a DPO in place. Well, why? Why have you got a DPO in place? I had it in an audit a few weeks ago. Why have you got a DPO? Well, because the previous data protection person thought we should have a DPO. They're a retail outfit. I don't think they need to have a DPO at all. You know, so, and that by contrast was at a client in December, and they had grown their business and taken some additional activities. And when we did our annual review, decided actually they did need to appoint a DPO, so they have So, yeah, it's one of those things, you know, this is a moving piece, isn't it? And therefore, everything should be kept under a periodic review, because you never quite, you know until you review it, what you're going to find.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Very good. There's another, actually, another support ticket I want to talk about with you in a short while. But before we get to that, let me set the context for it, which is a piece of news which I've seen this week. And longer-term listeners might remember that some time ago now, we discussed the fact that our favourite flat-pack furniture manufacturers, IKEA, had gotten themselves into quite a bit of bother relating to surveillance of staff in the workplace. And in particular, there was an instance where they'd been placing cameras in staff bathrooms, staff toilets. And obviously, that's not brilliant. It was to do with the fact that they had concerns about drugs usage on the premises, rather. And just recently, there's been another development in this, which is they're saying now that actually we thought it was perfectly warranted, and the problems have come in because the scope of the camera has shifted unintentionally, and now it's capturing more than what we wanted. So the angle has changed a little bit, which seems like a bit of a cop-out as far as I'm concerned, because I think if you're placing cameras in that vicinity in the first place, you're already not really off to a winner. But I thought this was interesting, because, as I say, it brings up the broader topic, which you and I had a little bit of a head-to-head about recently, which was in relation to using CCTV in disciplinary proceedings, right, in an employment context.
I remember that, yeah, I do remember that.
And I wanted to bring this up again, because actually we had a follow-up into support recently about something similar, and I wanted to gauge, A, your thoughts and the thoughts of all those on the session today, if anyone wants to contribute. But basically, we got asked by this customer, they got in touch and said, well, we've got some CCTV footage of an employee napping on the job, asleep at their desk, effectively. Are we able to use this in a disciplinary? Now, my instinctive response, without going back, but my instinctive reaction to that was, well, no, probably not. It's probably a bit excessive, etc. But then they went on to specify, and they said, well, actually, it's not just that they were asleep at the desk. This was a person who was responsible for providing 24-hour security for a building which houses vulnerable young people. Does that change things in terms of using it for disciplinary purposes? And actually, when I went and checked their privacy notice, it quite clearly said that this is something they would do. Like it outright
Ben,
said,
yeah, like Ben's highlighted, yeah.
Ben's highlighted instantly. You know, what do they state as their purpose? And it did include this. So my view is, anyone want to come and challenge me on this, but my view was, yeah, I think you're probably okay in this instance, to be honest with you. I mean, you'd have to check that it's not a contractor who's not been party to that privacy information, maybe check what the signage is like, as Emma quite rightly says. But I'm a bit more comfortable with that than I would be in other circumstances anyway. What's your take, Phil?
Well, I would agree with you. Yeah, I think it's material to the job they're doing, you know, to be awake and aware. And providing, you know, that protection. I think it's important. And I don't see why you wouldn't be able to use CCTV, especially if you've got it in your policy and in the signage and the were aware of the fact that there was CCTV and it might be used for these purposes, you know, monitoring of of wakeful state or whatever. Yeah, no problem for me. I don't think. I mean, ultimately, you know, what happens if you do get it wrong? You know, that they would then complain, wouldn't they, to the ICO? Yes, but presumably, if it's just an internal matter and they get disciplined, they may take to the ICO, they might not. If they get dismissed, they might go to an employment tribunal, mm-hmm. which again, your employer would be presenting this evidence. And I don't think would an employment tribunal consider whether there's been an infringement of data protection law? Don't know. But if it's just an internal thing, they complain to the ICO, the ICO would call in and say, let's have a look at what, you know, this situation. Oh, hang on, you Charlotte's got some.
Yes, I sorry, not to interrupt you, Phil, but yeah, what Charlotte's saying is very interesting, saying she's aware of a similar case where the ICO advised that if you cannot be expected to reasonably ignore what you've seen, you can take action on it, even if you were not recording for that purpose. So almost like you wouldn't be expected to turn a blind eye to something, basically, right? If you capture something on film which warrant action. I don't know, yeah. That's interesting.
Well, I think if you kind of go back upstream from this, you know, why are you using CCTV in that place, in the workplace anyway? Because you presumably have done a data protection impact assessment on it and possibly a legitimate interest assessment.
So that's possibly a bit of a bold assumption, Phil, but yeah, go on.
Well, assuming that you have gone through the proper, jumped through the proper hoops, then that CCTV is kind of in there for legitimate processing purposes, and has got suitable safeguard controls around it, one would have thought. So again, if you jump through all the hoops, then, you know, using the data at that point when you're wanting to take action, again, I think it strengthens your case, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Emma, again, raises a good point. What if it wasn't napping or stealing? Well, if it's stealing, then that's criminal behaviour, isn't it? So that's a lot easier to say, well, we're using the footage. I think it is. We're using the footage to take action because, you know, the Data Protection Act allows us to, you know, do this, you know, without providing privacy information in some cases, doesn't it, as well?
That's what I was going to say. Obviously, then you're in territory where you're exempt from privacy information.
Yeah.
But obviously a contractual matter, but which is effectively what a disciplinary is very different.
What if there's an altercation between staff? Nothing physical, just verbal. You know, bullying, for instance. Again, where would you draw the line? You could maybe tell from their body language that individual was being aggressive unnecessarily. But interesting. But again, I think having gone through DPA, LIA, et cetera, privacy policy signage, it's strangely busy, but you can't necessarily foresee all the circumstances where you're going to be using footage, you know, and therefore Charlotte's first point about, you know, you can't be reasonably expected to ignore what you've seen. Again, if you can use that as a kind of a citation, then it strengthens your case. But ultimately, you know, we've got to try and get the balance between, you know, the rights of controllers to, you know, run their organisations and the rights of individuals. And, you know, I think sometimes too much weight is given to the rights of data subjects in some circumstances like this, personally.
I don't think that's too outlandish an opinion. And actually, this is one thing I probably should have mentioned. One of the things I did go back and say was that I think in this instance, you're fine to do this. However, be aware that if your process behind that, so as you're saying, DPI, LIA, aren't right, you might be opening up a can of worms and you could expose yourself. But on the face of it, this one isolated use seems perfectly fine. But I think that's an interesting point you make there. And actually, weirdly, I'd seen some commentary about this earlier in the day from someone on the social saying that ultimately, as a DPO, who do you work for? I can't remember who brought this up. And if anyone knows what I'm referring to, pop it in the chat. But I just remember reading something, it was something to the effect of, yeah, who are you working for as the DPO at the end of the day? Yeah, Emma's right, it's Tim Turner, sorry, it was the DPO Daily wants it. And it's a very, very good point, actually, because you're right, Phil, it's what you're saying. At the end of the day, are we giving too much weight sometimes to the rights of data subjects? Sometimes are we a little bit prone to almost villainizing the controller and saying, you know, inherently the controller should be not subjugated to the data subject necessarily, but that there's this inherent sort of bias towards the rights of data subjects.
Well, but is there? Because I have to say, in vast majority of my dealings with the ICO, they generally side with the controller. In my opinion, in my experience, you know, the even the way that we have had this complaints about you know, would you reconsider where you are with things is a typical ICO response, isn't it?
Yes, but that's interesting then, because you're right, when we do tend to speak to them, it is very much same with the controller. So I suppose where does this come from, this idea that maybe you've got DPOs who are sort of not fighting their own organizations per se, but sort of tending to side with the protection of rights, even if that's not necessarily what the enforcement would support? It's an interesting question, and I don't necessarily have a response to it. And I think it's one of the things that got drawn out when you and I had that slight disagreement on this similar topic. we had a scrap in the car.
That brawl in the office.
Yeah. You kindly invited me outside.
Via the fire exit door.
But I do sometimes find myself in that same boat of being a little bit overprotective sometimes and a bit reluctant to say, yeah, go on,
well, I don't think
get on with it.
I think that, you know, we have to you know, accept responsibility for sticking up for data subjects, but it doesn't mean to say, you know, so you consider everything and then you know, it's wrong to not consider them. It's also wrong to give them too much weight. But that is the balancing act. You got to tread.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's interesting because contextually it can vary massively, because we're still seeing data subjects trying to sue some of our clients for you know, minor data breaches, something nothing. And in all those cases, I very much tend to side with the control and say, no, go away. You're not entitled to any compensation for this. It was something and nothing, you know, leave it alone.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe it's just one of those context-specific things, but certainly an interesting point to kick around. So all of that, anyway, to say that IKEA are in a bit of trouble.
Right. I was just going to kind of throw, this is kind of a complete aside, right? But one of our regular kind of attenders on these sessions is he's in Leeds today. So we said, well, come in the office and have a cup of tea. And if you want, you know, jump on the session with Ollie in the office. But he can't get there till 2 o'clock, which is a real shame. But this is kind of an edit to everybody. If you are in Leeds and you fancy just dropping in to see us, then do. And if it's a Friday and we're going to do one of these things, it'll be absolutely fab to have somebody kind of live in the quasi studio.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Completely second that. Unfortunately, we couldn't make that happen today.
Yeah. I mean, Ben makes a good point here that, you know, that the GDPR has been billed as a, you know, promotion of data subjects' rights and, you know, wrongdoing and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, maybe public perception, it's not as much public perception, this is privacy practitioners' perception, isn't it, that we're talking about here, where, you know, we're looking at a case and we're advising our colleagues and we're saying, oh, no, you can't use that. You know, you really can't help but put yourself in the, you know, position of your employer and commercial aspects and say, well, you know, yeah, we will do it. It's a tricky balance. Anyway, enough said, I think.
Possibly, but I enjoy this topic and I'm happy to keep exploring it. There's a couple of bits actually that I wanted to cover as well, and one of them actually offers me a bit of a segue from what you were just saying. So let's hop on that, which is that some of the more regular listeners, or at least some of you who have been with us a while, remember perhaps a time before we were this organised, which isn't saying much, but where part of my preparation, or at least a regular item that we had, was that we'd keep an eye on what the CNIL were doing. Because it's always interesting to see what another regulator is up to, how they compare to our own regulator, and also just to put the fact that I speak French fluently to good use, because otherwise it's just sort of sat there. But one of the things that I noticed when I went and had a look at the CNIL website today is that they are having this massive drive where they've signed up with basically one of the number one radio broadcasters in France to do basically a load of promotional work of educating people on what this is all about, demystifying it, you know, getting out to the general public and saying, look, you've got these rights and you probably need to know a little bit more about them. And they're even doing work in schools. They're even looking to introduce some educational materials and educating kids on what it all means, you know, in a digital world, to be able to be at least slightly more in control of your data and what that might entail. And I thought that was a really fabulous incentive. I really like it.
Yeah, that sounds a really good idea. Yeah, great. Yeah,
and what I picked out is that I've put a note here saying good initiative, but using the radio format to demystify the law sounds familiar. ... That was our idea, CNIL.
Yes.
But no, I thought that was quite good. Was there anything else that you picked out that you specifically wanted to cover? I know we need to get to the IDTAs at some point, but I'm sort
there
of
is,
putting it off for now.
Actually, and I'm just trying to find the email. We are in the process of recruiting some paralegal apprentices, as you know, Ollie. Yeah, and yes. The company that we're working with, the training provider we're working with, sent me an email yesterday to say that they were working on a data protection apprenticeship, a data protection practitioner apprenticeship, and would be interested in getting involved with it. Now, we know about Barry Malt's apprenticeship, but this is another one, I think. This is a totally separate thing. So it seems to me that there's going to be two data protection practice. I can't remember exactly how they termed it. But there seems like there's going to be two specific apprenticeships for our work, which is absolutely great. Because what we find with the paralegals is, you know, they go off to college and they have to do either commercial law or contract law or public law or whatever. But what they don't have any way of doing is specialising in data protection or information rights law. So that's kind of where we come in to provide them with that exposure. But it will be really good if this new apprenticeship is, you know, these two new apprenticeships are launched soon, you know, and that will be absolutely ideal for us and, you know, all our colleagues on this session to, you know, potentially put some of their staff through. So great. I'm just trying to find the email. In fact, I found it here. It's Damar Training that kind of we're working with, D-A-M-A-R Training, and they've got this kind of this link to the apprenticeship, information governance apprenticeships, data protection and information governance apprenticeships. Now, I don't know when they're going to be available, but I'm going to chuck that in the link. I hope they won't mind if I publicise it. I don't suppose it will do. Anyway, it's going to be too late in a second. So if you're interested in that, and we're really interested in this kind of stuff, because, you know, it's skilling people up, isn't it, in with the right skills and the right knowledge for the jobs that we need doing. So I wanted to flag that up as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's really valuable, because it is one of those things where this field is a bit of an odd one, and because I guess it's at least perceived as being relatively new, where sometimes it's quite difficult to understand how you even get into it. Where do you start? You know, so I think that can only be a positive, really. I'd have said. I don't know if anyone had anything else on that, or more broadly on training, Phil, that you wanted to discuss. Obviously, it's something which we're involved in heavily. But I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to discuss on
Not on that particularly. No.
No. Okay. Well, in that case, just one last thing before we get to the IDTAs. I'm teasing it and I'm building up to it, and really, we haven't even got that much to say. But we'll come to it in due course. One thing I did want to cover, which is slightly tangential, but I think still interesting, is this new Digital Markets Act, which is European, I believe.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anyone's come across it yet. I'm sure plenty of you will. But for those who haven't, basically, this is European statute. I'm not sure if it's what it says act there, but I don't know what its status is technically. But basically, it is aimed at, seemingly at least, reinforcing competition law within a digital space, within particularly internet service providers, but large corporations with a large internet presence and large platforms and websites. And basically, they sort of define the whole thing is built around this concept of gatekeepers, which are defined as sort of large online platforms. There are specific criteria to determine whether you're actually a gatekeeper or not. I haven't got them in front of me, but it's sort of based on the number of users, the amount of traffic you get, how many platforms you control, etc. But basically, it's aimed at stopping you, if you are one of these big players, at hoarding users and also of acting in unfair ways and towards those users. So it creates obligations on you and also stops you from doing certain things. Now, that all sounds a bit conceptual, the way I'm putting it across, because I'll be honest with you, I've not read it yet. I just read a summary. But effectively, it's things like if you have tools on your website, you're not allowed to sort of do self-preferential things like ranking your own products first in lists and things like that. That's the extent of it, as far as I can tell.
It seems to cover Internet of Things, data generated by Internet of Things devices as well. Again, I've not read it. I've flagged it to read because I thought, oh, this is going to be quite interesting to read through, the EU Data Act. But it's in force, isn't it? Now, it came into, adopted by the Commission on the 23rd of February.
Yeah. So I mean, it might not have snuck under the radar. It has my radar anyway. So some might say, where have you been this whole time? But and one of the things I picked out, Phil, was I don't know if you've seen this, the enforcement that can come with it, which is pretty chunky, because they're talking about potentially fines of up to 10% of your worldwide turnover for a first offence, which is quite a lot, but we're not necessarily, you know, averse to those numbers with the GDPR. But then for repeat offenders, a fine up to 20% of your worldwide turnover.
Wow.
Which is vast. And then if they're saying that if a gatekeeper systematically fails to comply with this, i.e. it violates the rules at least three times in eight years, not a huge amount, you'd have thought, the European Commission can open a market investigation and, if necessary, impose behavioural or structural remedies.
Wow. Great.
Which I'm very in favour of. That sounds particularly particularly potent. I like it. I like the sound of it.
It does. Right. So you wanted are you wanting to move on to the international data transfers?
Well, I suppose we need to talk about them, don't we? Because there's been a lot of noise about it, and it would be remiss of us to gloss over it, I think.
It would. And I have to confess, Ollie, that I've read a lot of stuff. I've downloaded all the documentation, and I've read through it, and I've prepared some kind of summaries and flowcharts and infographics, and I am still very confused as to exactly what you can do and when. So I don't think, you know, again, hopefully if people are aware of it that are on this, and maybe, you know, someone's got a better grip of it. Can I just start off by showing you some stuff to highlight why I'm confused with it?
Yes, please do, by all means. Probably not great for the podcast listeners, but we'll try and explain what you...
No, so what I'm looking at here is a PDF called the Standard Data Protection Clauses to be issued by the Commissioner under Section 119A1 of the Data Protection Act, in force 21st of March 2022. And so, this is just a two-page overview of the transitional provisions.
Transitional provisions, right.
Yeah. Now, on the last second page, it says a disapplication of paragraph 7 of Part 3 in Schedule 21 of the Data Protection Act 2018. So here's the Data Protection Act 2018 on the legislation.gov.uk website. And let's scroll down to Schedule 21. There isn't one. what am I missing?
Wait, hang on. What are you saying? In Schedule 21 of the Data Protection Act, are you using one of the... Yeah, Rob's right. You want to close some tabs, I think, Phil.
Yeah, I do.
Is it because it's showing you the latest version, so therefore it's already been taken out?
I've been back to old versions. You know, I've got open here an old version Data Protection Act. You know, and it finishes here, Schedule 20, Part 9. So I don't know whether there ever was a Schedule 21 of the Data Protection Act. I cannot possibly imagine this is a typo. But I mean, I would consider myself reasonably average intelligence and reasonably competent in this field of law. And I don't understand yet why. And I only found it just before the session when I rang you up 5 minutes before the session. I only found this and I thought, hang on a minute, you know, what's this all about? So I need to go do some digging. But there are other areas of this that I find very confusing. I'm just stopping sharing because I'm not going to show you all my tabs because I'll be embarrassed if you see all the tabs I got open. But again, we had the discussion, didn't we, about whether or not the new European standard contractual clauses, Article 46 ones, are able to be used in the UK. And again, I'm confused about that.
That's the bottom line, really, is where we're coming from, is that it is desperately unclear. I mean,
are we diving into the detail too fast, or do you want to do some introductory blurb?
Okay, let's just take it back a step, shall we? Which is that, without wanting to go too high level, but basically where we are transferring internationally under the GDPR, we have to have certain mechanisms in place to legitimise that transfer depending on where we're going, right? And one of those is the use of what are known as standard contractual clauses, which are contractual clauses which have been approved by, at the time, the European Commission as being sufficient for you to carry out your transfer if you enter into them with your importer and exporter. Now, to cut quite a long, complex story short, there was a new set of these published after we'd left the EU, at least during the transitional phase of us leaving the EU. So then that was complicated. Obviously, then now we're no longer in the EU, so that further complicates things. And now we're at a point where we basically have a bunch of sets of clauses and we don't really know which ones we're supposed to be using, as far as Phil and I are concerned anyway. But effectively, I think the point is that the ICO have come out with their IDTA, their International Data Transfer Agreement, which is supposed to be the new version that we're meant to be using. Now, it's not the only version, and part of the problem is the way that I have read, sorry if you can hear that in the background, someone's got quite a loud motorbike in the car park, and because it's a nice day, I've got the window open. Let me just close that window for you. There we go.
And can't hear it, Ollie.
My point. Oh, really? Oh, yeah. These microphones are brilliant. Anyway. Yes, yeah, so this IDTA is meant to be the set of terms that we're using. There's also an addendum which has been published, which as far as I understand it, and this is where Phil and I diverge slightly, you are supposed to be able to use in conjunction with the new, quote-unquote, European clauses, which we're not meant to have used up until now. But this is where we're struggling, right?
Yeah, because this is the ICO's website, again, for those who are listening not rather than viewing. And it's the bit where they're going to, for organisations, international transfers after the UK exit from the EU implementation period. And, you know, you scroll through it and you say, yeah, I get all this. I get all that adequacy stuff. I get about BCRs, Bank Corporate Rules, and I get about standard contractual clauses. And then you get to this piece, and this is what confuses me, if I'm being honest. So they talk about, you know, the standard contractual clauses, and the European Commission issued new EU SCCs on the 4th of June 2021. These are not valid for restricted transfers, which is what they call international data transfers in the UK, under the UK GDPR. Brackets, but see the next paragraph. So, right, okay, so I've got it in my mind here, these aren't valid, right? The old ones are, but the new ones aren't, in my mind. So then following a consultation, ICO has now issued new data protection clauses for restricted transfers, which will replace the old EU SCCs. And there's a new International Data Transfer Agreement, IDTA, and a new International Data Transfer Addendum, not called an IDTA, to the new European Commission SCCs. So these were laid before Parliament and will come into force on the 21st of March. Now, your take on this is that you could use the new EU SCCs with the addendum and that will be valid. My take on it is that you can't, because it clearly says up here you can't. Now, I've looked at Bird and Bird website. They're a reputable law firm, and I don't know if you've ever seen any of their, they do some fantastic blogs, Bird and Bird, Two Birds I think it's called, and what they say also is that you can't use the new EU SCCs. So you know, if I'm being honest, you know, we need to do some bit more reading, bit more thinking, but it just seems unnecessarily confusing.
Well, see, this is what we were coming up against off air, is that somewhere in that paragraph that you're showing on screen, it says that you cannot use the new European contractual clauses. And then about two or three sentences or maybe a paragraph lower, it says, when should you use the addendum? The addendum is an add-on to the new standard contractual clauses. Well, I thought we weren't supposed to use them, so why do we have an addendum for them? I mean, this is where it's fallen down. Like, as my understanding, and I'm perfectly happy to be challenged on this because I've not read it enough, but my understanding, as Phil says, is that you can currently, if you want to transfer data from the UK to a location which doesn't have an adequacy decision or elsewhere, which, to answer your question, Emma, that's the purpose of it, is to cover transfers which aren't covered by adequacy decisions. So yes, broadly outside the EEA, but also excluding places like I think Argentina and Israel have got adequacy decisions, haven't they?
Yeah. But the point is, this paragraph here, it says, however, as these new EU SCCs were adopted after Brexit, they're not valid for transfers to which the UK GDPR applies. So, you know, everyone's got the same documentation and is reading it and, you know, access to the same ICO website, but, you know, it isn't clear to me. Yeah. Well, it's not clear to me anyway.
Yeah, and just to be clear, my issue is by no means with Bird and Bird's interpretation of it, because to my mind, we're all in the same boat here, as we're all trying to make sense of this, and we're all struggling, because why is it so complicated? But yeah, I mean, basically, this is where we're at with it. I mean, I've been playing around with the addendum recently, because a customer's asked me to look at it for them, and I really like it. I think it's really good.
Which one? The new one?
So the addendum specifically.
The addendum, 9 pages long.
Yeah, which is, as you say, about 9 pages, and basically goes, it's basically a checklist which says, these bits of the SECs are amended to read this way because that makes sense for the UK. Bish, bash, bosh, you're done. And it's really straightforward. And this is part, if it is genuinely the case that we can't use the new SECs plus the addendum for our purposes, then I'm going to be quite frustrated about that, quite frankly, because I think they're great. And I think it works fantastically. The IDTA, the big one, the actual agreement.
This is the addendum, isn't it?
That's
at
the
now,
addendum.
So, yeah.
To me, the agreement is a bit long, so it takes the same format, but it's like 30 pages, which is getting on a bit. Whereas this is
similar structure.
It is, yeah, it is.
You know, but significantly longer.
Yeah. And I think.
And what they say also in the guidance is you have to have done your territorial due diligence before you even get to this point.
Yes, that's very true. Your TRA or your TIA or whatever you want to call it. Although, I have to say, I've been doing a couple of those recently, and those are getting easier and easier because there are...
Same, aren't they, for every time you look at the territory unless something's changed.
No, as in, I mean there are increasingly better resources that help you complete them. So those are getting a lot easier. And I think things are improving on this front, but it's still not clear enough. And of course, all of this is in the context of, you know, conversations around renewing Privacy Shield, or at least reviving it in some format, which I have to admit I'm not close enough to, but I don't know if you've seen that, Phil, that there's bits and pieces around that, at least rumblings.
This is the addendum, but these references to docking clauses is clearly a reference to the new EU SECs, isn't it? So,
I think what is clear is that the addendum is meant to be used with the new SECs. That
but
much
by
is
whom
clear.
Is the question? Into by EU? Whom? Yeah, but by, why would an EU organisation fill in the addendum when they're transferring data to the UK? Because they're not caught by the jurisdiction of the ICL. Maybe they are.
And either way, you'd have an adequacy arrangement in place, so why would you need to? Admittedly, one which is time-limited, but...
Exactly.
But I suppose this is what we like, but sometimes it can be frustrating. There's only so much grey area which we can all take, I think. And at a certain point, we need a bit of certainty on these things.
So don't know if anybody else on here has kind of got a different view or a supportive view or have read through this stuff, but... you know, we need to start using it from the new ones from the 21st of September. That's clear. So SCC's entered into from the 21st. So I did an infographic, which I won't bother to share because I will share. I'm not entirely sure it's correct. But on that premise, let me just flash it up to we can talk it through, can't we? So,
but what you're getting at there is that the all European SCCs, which are still currently valid in the UK, will cease to be valid, or at least you will no longer be able to enter into them from September.
Yeah, the guidance says SCCs entered into prior to the 1st of 2021, prior to exiting Brexit, continue to be valid until the 22nd of the 3rd, 2024, according to the ICO's website. This bit here, we can use the UK IDTA model from the 21st of March, i.e. last Monday just gone, and we must use them from the 21st of the 9th if we're entering into new ones. And then from the 22nd of the 3rd, we must be using them because all these ones at the bottom, you know, these SECs entered prior to the 1st of the 1st, 21, become invalid. So everybody has to be using the new SECs from the 22nd of the 3rd, as far as I can tell. The bit that I'm not sure about is this bit in the middle, you know, where we're in this period now, we're allowed to still use the old EU SECs until the 21st of the 9th, after which we've got to use a new model. But what about the new EU SECs? My red text here is you can't use them, because that's my current thinking.
Oh, there we go. Am I unmuted? I think I muted myself incorrectly. I'm back. Just to pick up on something you were discussing before, Phil, Andy originally was agreeing with you and saying he couldn't find a Schedule 21, but seems to have found one.
Oh, excellent.
So let's have a look at that, which, again, for podcast listeners...
No, there
listeners,
is, further
not the best,
provisions, yeah.
Not the best material, but yeah, there you go. So what is this basically? I don't know. I'm not going to read it now because we're recording this. But,
thank you, Andy.
But thank you,
I'll be
for finding
asleep
that
at night now. I was going to have to be hitting the whiskey to get dozed off.
Yeah, some people might think you're joking about that, but I know these are the things that do genuinely keep you up at night. So yeah, basically, bottom line is, in relation to all of this, and listen, there's no artifice here with us. We're confused by this, and we're honest with you, listeners. We're confused. We don't really know what the situation is. we'd quite like some clarity. Maybe it's just us, Phil. Maybe we're not reading it properly. But so far, no one on the chat seems to have disagreed, at least. So that seems like a positive.
No, maybe I've gone to make a cup of tea anyway.
Well, quite possibly. Quite possibly. So we've got about... no, Ben says it's not just us. Good. Thanks.
Oh, Mandy's saying 27th of December, 22. So there's other dates flying about as well, which is, you know, it's great. We just, I think we need to just kind of try and tease it out and... put something together and, you know, a rationale and citations as to why we think it's what it is. So at the moment, we're just talking about it and we put some bits on paper with some citations. But again, I say this every time I talk about the ICES website. You can find old stuff on the ICES website as well as new stuff. It's just not a well-managed site, is it? Or I don't think it is. I think it's a horrible site to use as a practitioner.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Actually, we again, this is another time we're bringing this up, but we had a support ticket in recently. We've not done this for ages, like London buses. We're not doing it for ages, and now they're all coming at once. We had a support ticket in which kind of related to this, and someone saying, I've heard there's some updated ICO guidance about whatever topic it is. Can you confirm what version it is, etc.? And that's part of the problem. They don't version control anything. It's impossible to work out.
And that's what I don't like about the website. But I much prefer a PDF. Right, it's hard-coded. I know what the version is. Yeah. If it changes, I know I've got the wrong version. But the website, you look at it one day and you think, I'm sure I didn't say that when I looked at it yesterday.
Yeah, it's an absolute nightmare.
But I tell you the truth, Ollie, I found this piece that flashed up on the screen saying you can't use them on the ICES website on Wednesday when I was talking to a client about international transfers, or just after, and I copied and pasted bits of it and I put it into a kind of advice note to say, you know, this is the situation, and I could not find the same page again on the ICES website. The only way I could find it was to go back to my advice note, copy the text verbatim, put it in Google and search for the text, and it took me to this page, but I couldn't find it anywhere through the ICO's, you know, guide. I was going, and this is one, another thing I don't like about it. Next, previous, different topic. I just find it really hard to use it. Maybe I'm just a Luddite. I don't know, but.
No, you are not just a Luddite. You are bang on.
I am a Luddite, but not just a Luddite. Thanks, Wally.
Not in relation to this specific topic. But no, I mean, you bang on. I had the exact same thing, and I think it's even the same page that you're talking about, which is I'd found it previously, and I was like, oh, I'd refer back to that. And it took me ages to find it. I didn't know where it had gone, and it's some sort of, I think it's a page which is international transfers after Brexit, guidance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a nightmare. Brenda agrees with us that it's not nearly...
Wouldn't it be great if they had, you know, the ICES website, you know, four organisations, you know, four data subjects, four practitioners, you know, and a different set of information, you know, and you know, properly managed, controlled and managed. Because we're looking at everything that everybody else is looking at and, well, struggling with bits of it.
Well, we've got the best endorsement we can thus far, which is Malcolm saying he used to work for the ICO and it is a nightmare.
You didn't need to manage the website, did you, Malcolm?
Because otherwise this might come off as a bit aggressive. Nope, didn't used to manage a website. Well, we're all good on that front at least. But I mean, you know, listen, our new ICO, John Edwards, is on his listening tour of the UK. Come to Leeds, please. Let's have a chat. We've got some feedback for you.
Yeah, come and have a coffee.
Yeah, come and have a coffee. But yeah, so basically, all of this still stemming from the IDTAs. But there's obviously plenty that comes out of that. And
Brenda saying she could look through a code of conduct and find it was from 2008. But it's not easy. I tell you what, looking at yesterday, you know, Wednesday again, I went back to the ICO's notification handbook, which again, if you've been around long enough, you'll remember the original one. I think it was the original one, 2007 or 2008, when we had to fill in all the forms when we made a registration to the ICO, and in there was, I mean, it was like an enormous form. You had to, there was all code for different data classes and code for recipients and code for personal data categories and stuff, and you had to fill in this form, a form, like a four-page form for every purpose of for processing. So this is the old registration thing that you know, GDPR said didn't work. And I looked through that because I was talking about ROPAs, and I was saying, well, you know, my take on it is that the part of the reason for keeping ROPAs was because the notification got scrapped from the directive to the GDPR. So let's have a look back at what was required in the early days for notifications, because that should inform us as the level of detail to have on a ROPA in theory. So yeah, we did that, and I was saying, look, you know, there's a finite list of data categories and data subject types and recipients, and it does say other, and you can add others in, but it was actually, I always find it quite instructive to go back to that and have a look at and think, well, if that's what they wanted then, and this Roper obligation is mostly, arguably, to replace that notification process, then why wouldn't the same level of detail be applicable?
I think that's a perfectly valid approach.
Anyway, that was quite good fun actually going through that. I do like looking through. So Brenda, it's good to keep some of this old stuff as well, because you know it's quite good to go back and see over time and see how things have changed and developed. And often you look at the ISO's guidance and it is dated 2008, and there's an introductory statement that says this hasn't been changed, but we don't recognise GDPR coming into effect, which again is really unhelpful.
Which is kind of the key point, really. It's all well and good keeping these things and them being valuable, but they need to be marked up as such.
They do. What was that about the Irish? The Irish data testing. Right, we lost. Just shift to Dublin. Thank you, Matthew. We'll move over there.
Yeah, Alan reckons there's not much on the website to organise, though. Which, listen, I'm not familiar enough, so I shan't speak. I don't want to get myself in trouble with the Irish DPC for whatever reason it would be. So we've got a couple minutes left. Phil.
What else do you want to talk about?
Well, there's one thing which we should acknowledge, because we're talking about it off air, and I feel a bit bad because we've not raised it yet. But long-time friend of the podcast and contributor Mark Leight popped in a link earlier before we started recording. We were talking about which, you know, I can't say too much about it because I'm not super familiar with it, but it is interesting and for a variety of reasons, which is that apparently I think it's British troops have been advised to avoid using WhatsApp. Over basically hacking fears that there's a link at the very start of the chat for all those that are on the session. You can scroll back and go and have a look. But obviously the fear is that Russia could hack WhatsApp and obtain information, access details, sensitive military details potentially about movements of troops, obviously in the context of what's happening in Ukraine. And it's interesting because Mark raised this, and I wasn't going to talk about it today, but I did see quite an interesting piece of the BBC about the fact that our Prime Minister has been receiving critical documents, really important documents, in his position, through WhatsApp. And they've been WhatsApping backwards and forwards on some key matters of state, which, you know, you can have varying opinions about it, but I think we're probably all in agreement that's not brilliant from a democratic process perspective. And it does raise this question, which is that, you know, should you really be using these channels, particularly without proper controls on them? I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Phil. It's a slightly high concept point to bring up, I appreciate, and we've only got 2 minutes. So,
yeah,
but yeah, I just thought it was worth raising.
Yeah, interesting. I've just noticed reading through your notes, Oliver, that you referred to the Digital Markets Act, and I was actually referring to the Data Act, which are two different things, I believe, when we were talking about that. So apologies if I said this is about Internet of Things data, because that's the Data Act, rather the Digital Markets Act. So there's two bits of legislation that we were talking about cross purposes. Apologies for that. Nah.
Good spot and good save. Good spot and good save. it's interesting that Digital Markets Act.
Now, what you're up to next week
is the Data Act. Go on.
Yes, what you're up to next week. I tell you what I'm doing next week. I am visiting, I've spent 4.5 days of visiting shops. How good's that, eh? Doing PCI DSS auditing. So I've got to go in, I've got 3 visits a day, various shops around the UK, this one chain, and I've got to be inspecting their card handling processes and their security awareness training and the way they're recording stuff and the delivery of their policies and procedures. So that's what I'm doing for the vast majority of next week, driving around and going shopping. Well, actually going shopping, visiting shops.
It's all right for some. Well, actually, when I tell you what I'm up to next week, you might be tempted to swap, even though most people wouldn't, which is I'm basically doing DPIAs all week next week.
Oh, are you?
Yeah. On various subjects. So I've got one to write up about someone's payroll function, which is a bit more run-of-the-mill, but still interesting. I've got one about the deployment of smart meters to a housing provider, which is interesting, all the data that collects. And I've also got one... Actually, I've got two. One about the use of augmented reality technology on a website and one about some analytics solutions and high-level cookie data usage, which I'm not allowed to talk about in too great detail. But very broad and very interesting, a range of topics. I know how much you like a DPIA, Phil. So
I love them. I think they're fab.
not to induce too much jealousy, but that's my week next week is DPIA.
I might be ringing you up as I'm driving along saying, oh, how are we getting on with the DPIA?
I'll tell you what, I'll fill you in on them in greater detail off air maybe, and then you can pick and choose which ones you want to be involved in.
Jolly good. Right, it's excellent. Half past one, Ollie.
It is indeed 1:30, so let's bring it to a close. Thank you very much, Phil, for your time this afternoon. Particularly appreciate it, as I know how busy you are. But I thought that was an excellent chat, and we will be back next week, won't we?
Chat. We've not actually solved anything or shed light on anything. We just added to the confusion.
Phil, people don't come here for answers. Otherwise, we'd have. Otherwise, this podcast would have failed a long time ago. Good chat. Thank you all for your time. Thank you all for attending. As I say, we'll be back next week with another event. I've already forgotten what it is. I'm sorry, Miles. I don't retain this information. But if you want to find out what's on next week, just head to the events page on the DPP website. You can sign up there as well for events to future sessions. If you're not currently signed up, Miles is flashing the list on the screen now. It is. Oh, we're talking about due diligence next week. This is one that was suggested by a regular listener and contributor. What do we need? What's it all about? What is actually involved? Why do we do them? What's the value in them? How can we tailor them? What sort of things are we looking for? I think that's potentially quite interesting, Phil, because it's something we talk around a lot. But I'm looking forward to that. That's suggested by a regular listener, as I say, a long-time contributor. So
right. We better do some prep then.
We better do some prep, but that's what we'll be back with. In the meantime, I hope you all have a lovely weekend and make the most of the weather while it lasts. And we will see you all very soon, I'm sure.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Thank you very much and see you soon. Have a good weekend.
Take care, all.